Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, broadcasting a special edition of Background Briefing from Capitol Hill, just across the street from the Supreme Court, where people are gathering for tomorrow's very important hearings on the Affordable Care Act, which went through a near-death experience with Chief Justice John Roberts saving it. Now the Conservatives have a second bite of the apple with a very specious case that's been brought by the four justices who voted to strike down the Affordable Care Act the last time. And of course, Capitol Hill today is very lively. We had Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu speaking to the Congress this morning. There were vast demonstrations, one very colorful demonstration by a group of Orthodox Jews holding up signs, "Netanyahu, go home, you don't speak for the Jewish people." And of course, the speech that Prime Minister Netanyahu gave was rather cynical, in the sense that he spent a lot of the time praising his good friend Barack Obama, which of course is far from the case. So let's now go to today's program, where we have talked to a number of people involved in the both getting the Affordable Care Act through and now defending it in what could be a life or death situation. We'll begin with Ian Millhiser, who is a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress and the author of Injustice, the Supreme Court's History of Comforting the Comfortable and Afflicting the Afflicted. Then we will hear from Michelle Schwartz, who is the Director of Justice Programs at the Alliance for Justice. And then we'll hear from David and Mary Tedrow, who are American citizens who have benefited from the Affordable Care Act and now are faced with the alarming prospect that their improvements to their lives and welfare could be taken away by the Supreme Court. Then finally, we'll hear from Stuart Eisenstadt, who is a former U.S. ambassador to the European Union, Jimmy Carter's domestic policy advisor and deputy treasury secretary under former President Bill Clinton. He will provide us with a long history of attempts to bring about health care, culminating with the Affordable Care Act. And now the irony is, of course, after years, going back to Harry Truman, finally what has been achieved could well be taken away. Joining me now is Ian Millhiser, who's a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress and the author of Injustices, the Supreme Court's History of Comforting the Comfortable and Afflicting the Afflicted. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ian Millhiser.
It's great to be here. Thanks so much.
And that is that the famous Muckraker's expression?
Yeah, I think it was H.L. Mencken.
H.L. Mencken, right.
And unfortunately, the Supreme Court has done a good job of turning it on its head throughout its history. You know, as I discussed in Injustices, the Supreme Court has done they stood for segregation. They struck down child labor laws. They stood for eugenics and held that a woman could be sterilized against her will.
Right.
And I'm worried that in this healthcare case that they'll be hearing tomorrow, they're going to return to their old ways. And as many as 13 million people, depending on which estimates you look at, could wind up losing their health insurance because of this King v. Burwell case.
But isn't there this phenomenon called Supreme Court shopping, which the right have perfected in this country? The David Bossie, who was an obscure filmmaker, used to work for Dan Burton, the congressman. He doctored the tapes of Webster Hubbell, who was Clinton's attorney general nominee, who never, and doctored the tapes of his conversations with his wife to incriminate him. He's a real hardcore right-wing Republican activist, and yet somehow or other his film about a hit job on Hillary became the basis of the Citizens United decision, and everybody at the time thought, well, they'll rule on the very narrow nature of this case, but suddenly they blew the whole thing up. So my understanding is that there is a similarity here, that we have to really watch this with a certain amount of anxiety, because these characters that brought this case to the Supreme Court are such hardcore activists. It's extraordinary.
Yeah, no,
one of them said that, you know, this has got to, this this has to be killed off as a matter of political hygiene.
Yeah, no, I've the same person who said that also compared the Affordable Care Act to the Holocaust. So you're not dealing with the most level-headed people who are bringing these lawsuits, and yet.
But my question is, yeah. Why are the Supreme Court taking? Why do they take Bossie, and why do they take this case from these two conservative activists, Michael Grieve and Thomas Christina?
So, I mean, those folks like me who followed the court for a while and, you know, who've been trained in the law, I think we've been staring down a long rabbit hole for a while trying to figure out where it ends. You know, this started when Justice Alito was confirmed in 2006. He replaced Justice O'Connor, who was a moderate Republican, and Alito is extraordinarily conservative. And since then, conservatives have been bringing these lawsuits, trying to test how far the court is willing to go to push a very conservative agenda. And the answer looks like it may be very far. You know, certainly it was very far in Citizens United. Certainly it was very far when they struck down the Voting Rights Act. The fact that there were four justices willing to repeal the entire Affordable Care Act last time around was shocking to me. I mean, that wasn't a particularly strong lawsuit either. But this one, you know, the idea behind this lawsuit is that if you take the 1,000 pages of the entire Affordable Care Act and you squint so hard that you only see six words of the law, then it's okay to take health care away from millions of people. That's what the theory is behind this lawsuit. We're going to cull through it, these plaintiffs said. We're going to find the one phrase that if you don't read any of the context, if you don't read any of the passages defining what those words mean, if you only read those six words lifted out of the out of the law itself, they seem to suggest that people in up to three dozen states aren't allowed to have tax credits that are supposed to help them pay for their health insurance. And if the Supreme Court agrees, what happens is all of a sudden millions of people can't afford the health care overnight. What happens is the insurance markets destabilize because, you know, the insurance companies assumed that they'd have a certain number of healthy people in, you know, buying health insurance, that they'd have enough revenue to pay out all the expenses that they have. What happens is that the hospitals start to suffer because they don't have people paying for care. They have people showing up at the emergency room demanding uncompensated care. And most importantly, what happens is, according to one estimate, as many as 10,000 people are going to die every year. And we're talking about a whole lot of husbands who don't get to hold their wives again. We're talking about a whole lot of fathers who don't get to kiss their daughters again if this case goes badly. So that's what's at stake. It's, are the justices capable of reading more than one sentence? Or are they going to keep following that rabbit hole down that gave us cases like Citizens United in order to implement a very dangerous and very partisan agenda?
And are these justices likely to listen to the very drafters of this law, mm-hmm. whose intentions were clear, and because of sloppy drafting or mm-hmm. even typos,
right.
they have allowed these activists an opening to scuttle the whole thing based upon just a few words, as you've pointed out. So you would think in the real world, the people who drafted the Affordable Care Act could get up and tell the Supreme Court justices, look, this was our intention.
Right.
This is not our intention.
So I want to be clear about one thing, which is this isn't a case where the text of the law is contrary to the intentions. You know, the law is drafted, you know, maybe in a way that's more complicated than it should be drafted, but it is clear that it only means one thing. So the plaintiffs hone in on these six words, an exchange established by the state. And they claim that because an exchange established by the state is not an exchange established by the federal government, that means that if you live in a state with a federally run exchange, you're not entitled to tax credits. The problem is that the word exchange is actually defined in the law. And it's defined to say that any exchange, regardless of who runs it, shall be deemed to be an exchange established by the state. So every time you see that word exchange, it's referring to an exchange established by the state. That's what that definitional passage does. There are various provisions of the law that become completely absurd. There's one, for example, the provision of the law that deals with who can buy and who can sell in the health insurance exchanges refers to the state that established the exchange. So if the plaintiffs are right about how to read the law, that means no one is allowed to buy health insurance in the federally run exchanges, and no one is allowed to sell health insurance in the federally run exchanges. Why on earth would would Congress create this whole apparatus that no one's allowed to do anything with? It doesn't make sense. The only way to make sense of the law is to recognize that all exchanges are the same. That's what the law says, to recognize that we can't read these six words of the law completely out of context, and to uphold the tax credits in all 50 states.
And again, I'm speaking with Ian Millhiser, who's a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress and the author of Injustices, the Supreme Court's History of Comforting the Comfortable and Afflicting the Afflicted. But again, there is a surreal nature to this because, the intention's clear. The people, this was a massive political struggle.
Right.
And it barely got through. And the idea that suddenly these sort of outsiders,
right,
opportunists looking for a way to scuttle it have found a tiny little chink in the armor and they're going to drive a truck through it.
Yeah.
And that's the part of it that's amazing. And the fact that it's got this far and the fact that we've seen similar things happen with Citizens United is really what's got me concerned. And so let's talk about, you mentioned Alito as the real radical. I mean, I remember at the time of his hearings being alarmed at a lot of Democrats, including Cass Sunstein, who went to work for Obama, mm-hmm. suggesting he wasn't so bad. And I thought, I couldn't believe that they weren't aware of... Nobody ever questioned in these confirmation hearings. They never asked these guys whether they're corporatists. And you've basically got, five corporatists there. And, there's a big difference between public interest law and corporate law, isn't there?
So, the thing about it, though, is the confirmation process itself has become a bit of a joke, where, basically there's two types of confirmation hearings people get. You either get the, we're going to stop you at all costs and we don't care about who you are or what your record is hearing. And a lot of Obama's nominee have gotten that hearing. Or you get the nominee just going to get up and say a bunch of vague things that don't tell you anything about them, and there'll be a lot of theater for 2 or 3 days, and then they'll get through anyway. And that's the hearing that Roberts and Alito got, George W. Bush's two nominees. And in fairness, to a certain extent, that's the hearing that, both of Obama's Supreme Court nominees have gotten. Our confirmation process has not proved effective in screening nominees. And I think a reason, probably the reason for that is because most people, I think, are not aware of what the Supreme Court is capable of doing when it is at its most aggressive. What I discuss in Injustices is how in the lead up to the Great Depression and in the early days of the New Deal, the Supreme Court was very aggressive in striking down pretty much everything that liberals wanted to accomplish, including striking down child labor laws. And they so severely overreached that Roosevelt put a lot of pressure on them, and eventually they backed down. And most Americans have grown up in this era where, the justices were sort of cowed by that experience, and they didn't behave as aggressively as they've behaved in the past. But ever since Chief Justice Earl Warren retired in 1969, with each passing year, the court has become more conservative. It's become more aggressive. Conservative activists, Republican politicians have figured out that they have a big friend in the court. And as we travel further and further down this rabbit hole, it's starting to look a whole lot like the 1930s looked. They're starting to realize that these same things that they did in the past to try to, prevent there from being any kind of governance, basically to make elections irrelevant so that no matter whether we had a Democrat or Republican in the White House, they couldn't pass an agenda that conservatives disagreed with.
But this has led Linda Greenhouse, who's always been a very moderate, reasonable journalist who's covered the Supreme Court in a very, very consistent and very deep way. And she recently wrote an op-ed coming to the conclusion that maybe these guys are Republican political activists in robes.
Yeah.
And is it possible that they are looking at the big demographic picture where white men are becoming an endangered species, the minorities are growing, and that they've made a cynical decision that in order to level the playing field with the Democrats who have a natural demographic advantage, not that they take advantage of it, but it's there, that they will allow unlimited amounts of money from plutocrats to buy the elections and suppress the vote?
No, I mean, there's certainly a last stand sort of element to it. I mean, I don't know how far this sense that they're making a final stand reaches. But I mean, you know, you can turn on Fox News, you can listen to anything that you hear from the Tea Partiers, and they speak in these apocalyptic terms. You know, I mean, they truly believe that this law that just makes sure that millions of people who are uninsured get health care is an existential threat to something essential about the United States. I mean, you hear it pervading Mitt Romney's presidential campaign. You hear it pervading the attacks you hear on President Obama, this notion that something precious about America is threatened by liberalism itself. And I know for a fact, because they've said so, that a lot of the justices read those outlets and watch those news stations that are spouting these views. And, you know, I don't necessarily have any reason to think that, like, you know, it's Justice Alito, for example, or Justice Kennedy or Justice Scalia thinks differently than anyone's right-wing uncle. The difference is that these right-wing uncles happen to wield a whole lot of power, and they've shown that they aren't afraid to use it.
So a lot of people are taking comfort in the fact that Chief Justice John Roberts allowed the Affordable Care Act to survive. Mm-hmm. And as you pointed out earlier, it was pretty shocking that four justices were ready to kill it without any legal basis, not that they have any now with the second bite of the apple. And so have they been working on him? Is he wavering? That's where people are taking comfort. They think that it's going to be another 5-4 ruling.
Right.
And it's logical. If they voted against it last time, why would they not vote against it this time? So we know the four are going to be voting against this.
Right. So, unfortunately, there's only one person who knows what's going on in Chief Justice Roberts' head, and that's Chief Justice Roberts. What I think that the good guys have going for them in this case, though, is, you know, Roberts did show in the past, you know, one of the leading theories for why he voted not to kill the law the first time around is that he's concerned about the institutional legitimacy of his court. You know, the Supreme Court isn't like Congress or president where they have an electoral mandate. You know, the Supreme Court's legitimacy flows entirely from its willingness to be obedient to the law. And I think that Roberts realizes that there's a point where he can go so far that people start to say, well, wait, like, if these guys aren't following the law and they weren't elected, you know, why are we listening to them in the first? Why are we listening to them anyway? I think he realizes that there is a point where his legitimacy can run out. And I am hoping that in this case, where there is no legal basis for him to strip so many people of their insurance, and where there are so many lives at stake, that he will realize that, you know what, this is a bridge too far. You know, that people will and they should lose faith in the Supreme Court if the court is, you know, does something so egregious as to vote with the plaintiffs in this law.
Well, would it have a political backlash? I mean, one of the problems in this country is that you have the minority party have got all the money, all the motivation. Fox News gets them all riled up. They don't have the numbers, but they get all their people out to vote. The other side have a natural majority, but they don't inspire their people to vote. I'm talking about the Democrats.
Right.
Is it possible that this time around, if they kill this in such a flagrant and partisan way, that enough Americans are going to get riled up to literally come out and vote, which they didn't do in the last election?
No, I mean, that raises, you know, what is the core of much of America's problem, which is that we have two electorates in this country. We have the electorate that turns out when there's a presidential candidate on the ballot, and we have the electorate that turns out in every other election. And the electorate that turns out in every other election is much, much smaller. And, you know, and you're exactly right. Like, ultimately, the way to stop bad justices is to keep electing people who won't allow more bad justices to be appointed. And, you know, Scalia and Kennedy are both pushing 80. Like, you know, eventually this is going to shake itself out if there are people in office who aren't going to replace them with younger versions of themselves. So, yeah, I mean, elections matter. And if the next president of the United States is someone who doesn't see things the way that Justice Scalia sees things, and if the next Senate is controlled by people who doesn't see things the way that Scalia sees things, eventually, you know, there's an obvious solution. You know, the problem is we don't know when that's going to happen, and the Supreme Court can do a whole lot of damage in the years between then and now.
So just in closing then, I take it you don't appreciate it when people say there's no differences between Democrats and Republicans in terms of voting. They're all, you know, plague on all their houses. There is a difference when it comes to the Supreme Court.
Yeah, I mean, well, there's a huge difference between the justices who are appointed by Democrats and the justices who are appointed by Republicans.
And we may find out in the worst possible way.
That's exactly right.
In June, right?
Yeah, I mean, what we might find out is the difference is whether or not 10,000 people get to live or die.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Ian Millhiser.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Ian Millhiser, who is a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress and the author of Injustices, the Supreme Court's History of Comforting the Comfortable and Afflicting the Afflicted. We can take a brief station break. We'll be back joined by Michelle Schwartz, the Director of Justice Programs at the Alliance for Justice.
Outside the patient millions, put them into power. Expect a little more back for their taxes. Like school books, beds in hospitals, and peace in our bloody time. All they get is old men grinding.
And welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is a special edition of Background Briefing from Capitol Hill. We're right across the street from the Supreme Court, literally a stone's throw away, and I'm joined by Michelle Schwartz, who is the Director of Justice Programs at the Alliance for Justice. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michelle Schwartz.
Thanks, Ian. It's great to be here.
And Michelle, this situation is really quite surreal, the idea that essentially a typo, a few words can undo all of those years of work. We remember watching the passage of the Affordable Care Act as Obama's singular achievement. It barely made it through. It was a titanic political battle. And yet, here it is before the Supreme Court on Wednesday, where they could, as they did with Citizens United, take Supreme Court shopping from right-wing political activists and blow it into something that's completely unrecognizable and changes the political landscape of America.
Well, and I think that the comparison to Citizens United is particularly apt because, like with that case where the Supreme Court decided a question that wasn't even before it, and they sent the case back and said, no, we really want to decide this bigger question, so brief this for us. And then they, what we call, it's really this massive overreach by the Supreme Court to reach that decision. It's the same thing here. It's a huge overreach for the Supreme Court even to be taking up this case. You know, the Supreme Court, they get to decide which cases they hear. And it's a very limited number each year. And so usually they limit that to where there's something called a circuit split, meaning that the lower federal courts of appeals are split on this question. And they feel like they need to step in and resolve that so that you don't have a different law applying to you depending on where you live in the country. Well, that's not the case here. There's one federal appellate court decision on this issue. They said, yeah, of course the Affordable Care Act provides tax subsidies, these tax credits to people who purchase on the exchange no matter where they live in all 50 states. They said that was crystal clear. And no other federal appeals court went the other way. And yet, at least four justices of the Supreme Court, we don't know who they are, we don't know why they did it, they thought that this was a ripe time to take up this case. And so it's scary that they would even do that, and on a case that's going to have such a profound effect on people's lives. And you're right too. You know, I was working in the Senate when the Affordable Care Act was passed, when it was signed into law. I know how hard we worked on it. And it would be completely opposed to the intent of this law, the purpose of this law, if the Supreme Court were to decide the way the plaintiffs want them to decide. But it's also, frankly, contrary to even the text of the law if you read it as a whole, which is how you're supposed to do it.
Right, but let's assume that you're the person who brought this case, this law into being. I know thousands of people worked on it, but just for the sake of the argument, and you suddenly wake up and find out that all your work is going to be taken away because of a typo, and are you able then to go to the judge and say, look, this is not my intention, this is a mistake, these people are opportunists, they've just grabbed onto something that suits their political purposes but has nothing to do with the Affordable Care Act that I drafted, and I'm telling you, this is not the intention of the act. What they're doing has nothing to do with the intention of the act.
Well, and I think you can do that, and there are briefs that have been filed in the Supreme Court doing that. But I would say that in this case, we're not actually even talking about a typo. That when you look at, you can't read seven words of a massive statute. And, you know, we remember when this bill was being debated and members of Congress, you know, Republican members of Congress and Republican senators were going down to the floor with these huge piles and they were saying, look how big this bill is and look how long and look how many words are in here. And now they're saying we're only supposed to look at seven of those words. That's not how you read a statute. And so legal authorities, you know, law professors who are the experts on reading statutes, they filed a brief where they quote Justice Scalia, who is arguably the justice on the Supreme Court who has talked the most about how do you read statutes, how do you interpret the text. They've quoted him back to himself and said, this is, you know, the law that you learn in the first semester of law school, that you don't read a statute based on seven words. You read the whole statute. You have to look at the context. You have to look at everything in that statute and how this fits into the overall statutory scheme. If you read those seven words in the context of this whole statute, it is crystal clear that these tax credits are supposed to apply to everybody in all 50 states.
Again, I'm speaking with Michelle Schwartz, who's Director of Justice Programs at the Alliance for Justice. But you mentioned the four Supreme Court justices who are nameless, but they did bring this peculiar case, which is being argued tomorrow right across the street from where we are today. And so much is at stake, it's just breathtaking. But there were also four justices that voted, you know, in favor of killing this the first time around. This is the second bite of the apple for this. So you have to assume it's the same four guys, right? Minus Roberts.
That would be the assumption. That's the likely assumption. But, you know, funny things can happen on the Supreme Court. I mean, you never know, and there can be strange bedfellows, but that's the safe assumption. But it's interesting because even those four guys, you look at that dissent that they wrote, and in that dissent, they talked about how the whole Affordable Care Act, that all these pieces fit together. And in that case, they were talking about what happens if you get rid of the individual mandate. They said, if you get rid of of the individual mandate, the whole scheme falls apart because this is a broad statutory scheme, and you've got all these different parts of it, and they all rely on each other. So all of the things that people love about the Affordable Care Act, like no being denied health insurance for pre-existing conditions, no lifetime caps on coverage, those kinds of things, those are all going to fall apart if you don't have this individual mandate. So they understood that. They understood this was all part of a large program that, you know, all relied on each other. And that's what we're facing in this case. Because if you get rid of these tax subsidies for Americans living in 36 states, then what happens is immediately you've got 8+ million Americans who lose health insurance. But because those 8+ million Americans lose health insurance, and a lot of those are healthy, and they're the ones who, you know, you're relying on to have a balanced insurance market, those people don't have health insurance. The insurance companies raise their rates to compensate for that. Then more people can't afford insurance, and you go into what people are referring to as this death spiral, where the whole thing falls apart and countless millions of Americans are losing their insurance. And so that's what we're looking at. And that's something that those four dissenters, they understood and they wrote about that. So they should understand that now. And maybe, you know, maybe I'm a little naive and I'm too, you know, and I'm really hoping for the best. And I'm hoping that they see that here.
But one of the people who brought this second bite of the apple to the Supreme Court, which the same four justices have taken up, which has us alarmed, and it's the reason why we're here right across from the Supreme Court, and people are demonstrating. Michael Grieve, the libertarian with the Libertarian Competitive Enterprise Institute, he has seized upon these few words, and this is how he describes. I can't use the word this. B word, which we'll get a $250,000 fine if we'd use it on the air. This B word has to be killed as a matter of political hygiene. I do not care how this is done, whether it is dismembered, whether we drive a stake through its heart, whether we tar and feather it and drive it out of town, whether we strangle it. I don't care who does it, whether it's some court someplace or the United States Congress. So that's fighting words, right?
This is
the guy that's brought the case to these justices.
And what's missing from that is all of the people who will be hurt if that happens. And so this idea that because of some political vendetta, you are going to get rid of this law that is helping millions of Americans who literally never had insurance before, who went to bed at night worried and sleepless because they were concerned, what happens if I get sick? What happens if my child gets sick? Am I going to be able to afford food if that happens? Am I going to have to file bankruptcy if that happens? And these people have health insurance. And you know, when I was sitting waiting to talk to you, I'm talking to some of these people who have come to Washington to tell their stories. And to think about them having to lose health insurance and that somebody is on this political mission to get rid of this law is just unfathomable to me.
Well, just in closing, Michelle Schwartz, if it's down to Justice Roberts, which it clearly is, I think, and last time around he saved it, and I'm sure that they've been working on him, both these four guys who shall remain nameless, but we know who they are, and the whole right-wing establishment. I mean, it's pretty clear. They're deranged in the hatred of Obama. I mean, it's pathological. And here we are on this peculiar day in Washington where you have the Israeli Prime Minister, Bibi Netanyahu, invited by this Congress that hates the president to use the Congress as a platform to attack a sitting American president. It's, so much is unprecedented about what is happening. This is what worries me, that we're in a sort of new territory of right-wing derangement. And that's why I can't rest easy. I'm not confident that this thing could blow up in our faces in June.
I think that's a valid concern, and I'm not going to claim that I'm not having some sleepless nights over it. I think that, you know, let's hope that Justice Roberts actually follows the law, Chief Justice Roberts actually follows the law. I think that there's maybe a chance that if he does that, he could maybe even bring Justice Kennedy along with him. Who knows? But it's possible. And, you know, just last week, there was a case that came out of the Supreme Court that had to do with fish and the Sarbanes-Oxley Act, and two things that nobody ever really thought would go together. And in that case, which is a little obscure, but it did have to do with statutory construction and whether you look at the overall statutory scheme and the purpose of the statute and the whole statute and not just a few words of it. And Justice Ginsburg wrote the majority opinion there where she talked about the need to look at all the context of the statute. Chief Justice Roberts joined that opinion. So you never know what can happen in the Supreme Court. I hope that the right thing happens, but I think that if the right thing doesn't happen, then there are two things that people need to be thinking about. One is, you know, they better be putting huge amounts of pressure on Congress, and I know it's going to be tough, and it will be very difficult to get anything to happen, but there should be a lot of pressure. And the other thing is that how tremendously important it is who sits on our Supreme Court. And so people should realize this is not something where they don't have a say in what the Supreme Court is doing, because, you know, the next president could be appointing up to four justices to the Supreme Court. By 2018, there will be four Supreme Court justices in their 80s. And it is critically important that people are thinking about that when they're going to the ballot box. They're thinking about who is going to be the next president, who's going to be sitting in the Senate, and who they're going to put on the Supreme Court.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Michelle Schwartz.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Michelle Schwartz, who's the Director of Justice Programs at the Alliance for Justice, and she joins me right across from the Supreme Court here on the day before the big decision on whether or not the Affordable Care Act will survive. And I'm joined by David and Mary Tedrow, who are healthcare consumers, and I take it that you're concerned and you're here to make your voices heard in these protests at the Supreme Court, as the Supreme Court then takes a second bite at the apple that could possibly undo the Affordable Care Act. So have you been beneficiaries of the Affordable Care Act?
Yes.
Explain your situation prior to that, and then what did the Affordable Care Act do for you?
Okay. Well, it's because of the Affordable Care Act that I'm here today, actually. The Affordable Care Act has enabled me to obtain insurance, first of all. I was diagnosed in 2010 with non-alcoholic cirrhosis. The only cure was a liver transplant. My wife and I had a small business at that time. It was very successful. But the fun stopped then. And I had to start looking at taking care of myself as I became unhealthy. And
well, we had to close our store because you were too ill to run it.
And tell me then, have you benefited from it? I mean,
absolutely. The policy that I had prior to the Affordable Care Act coming on board was a high risk, high deductible pool policy. With my diagnosis, I was unable to get open market insurance. And so I was only available, the only policies available to me were the high-risk pool policies. That policy ended on December the 31st, 2013, and on January 1st, I picked up a plan through the marketplace.
Through the Affordable Care Act.
Right. And I became extremely ill in March. In April of 2014, I did receive a liver transplant. At any time, if I had ever lost insurance, I would have been dropped from the transplant list. And so fortunately, I was able to maintain my standing on the list and to get the transplant. It came right as I was technically at death's door.
So at this point, with the Supreme Court poised to revisit the Affordable Care Act, which we all thought was settled, but some conservative activists have seized upon some four words that are sort of almost like typos that provided enough ambiguity for them to challenge so much of the Affordable Care Act that it could render it pretty moot for a lot of people, 8 million Americans at the very least. Are you vulnerable in that regard? Which state are you from?
And I'm from North Carolina. We do not have a marketplace in our state. You bring up two, I think, very significant points. Currently, the only income we have is from disability. With disability income, that's hard enough to live on, period. And if we had to pay for insurance completely without the benefit of a subsidy, it would not work. We could not afford the insurance. I have to be on anti-rejection drugs and chemotherapy for the rest of my life. That is an unaffordable combination without the subsidy. The second thing is the act itself, the Affordable Care Act, you have to look at the law in its entirety. It has made health care insurance affordable to everyone. And I underline the word affordable. If we lose the subsidy, I think the entire policy or the entire law will collapse. And if that happens, we're going to go back to where we were before the Affordable Care Act? Is that not? I mean, that's probably the most unfair thing that could ever happen.
Well, Mary, how do you feel, though, about this surreal nature of this Supreme Court hearing and the fact that it's got this far when the intention of the people who drafted the law is so clear? And yet, because of, sloppy drafting, leaving a small ambiguity, four words, it's provided this opening to take the whole thing down. And how confident are you that the justices will see the bigger picture and listen to those that drafted the law to make their intentions clear, as opposed to those that are finding an opportunistic way to undo the whole thing for their own political reasons?
I just pray that they can look at the bigger picture. This should not be a political issue. This is about human beings with real problems, real lives that'll be greatly affected. It's going to, the Affordable Care Act has given hundreds of thousands of people hope. It's given people health care that didn't have it, drugs they needed that didn't have it. And if this thing goes, if they do away with the ACA, people are going to start dying, literally. My husband didn't tell you the full story. We would have to pay probably $1,500 a month for just the premium, monthly premium, on top of $6,000 a month for his medication. It's not feasible. And his is just one story out of hundreds of thousands. And I think it would, we are the only powerful country left in the world that does not have affordable care for its citizens. We just started, thank God, but if they push this back, it's going to hurt hundreds of thousands of people and put us back to square one.
Well, I pray that it doesn't happen, and I thank you both for joining us here today at this demonstration across from the Supreme Court.
Okay.
Thank you.
Very grateful to your story. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back getting a history of attempts to bring about health care, going back to President Truman, from Stuart Eisenstadt, former U.S. Ambassador to the European Union, Jimmy Carter's domestic policy advisor, and Deputy Treasury Secretary for President Bill Clinton.
Doctor, my eyes have seen the years and the slow parade of fears without price. Now I want to understand. I have done all that I could to see the evil and the good without hiding. You must help me if you can.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is a special edition of Background Briefing from Capitol Hill, across the street from the Supreme Court, on the day before the Supreme Court hears a challenge to the Affordable Care Act, and in effect a second bite at the apple. There was a near-death experience a while back, and Chief Justice John Roberts allowed the Affordable Care Act to go ahead. Four justices voted to kill it back then, and four justices also brought this second case to the Supreme Court. So I think it's pretty easy to do the math. Once again, we're back with the one justice will decide one way or the other. And joining me is Stuart Eisenstadt, who's a former U.S. ambassador to the European Union. He was formerly the domestic policy advisor for President Jimmy Carter and a deputy treasury secretary for President Bill Clinton. So, Stuart Eisenstadt, do you find this a little surreal, the idea that all of this work, all of this intention is vulnerable to essentially a group of highly motivated political partisans who've seized on a few words in a vast bill to turn the whole thing inside out and perhaps kill it?
Yes, and if I may give you my précis of little history. Presidents since Harry Truman in 1948 have tried to get national health insurance passed. During the Carter administration, when I was the president's chief White House domestic policy advisor from 77 to 81, with a heavily Democratic Congress, I came very close to negotiating an agreement with Senator Kennedy. And we had everything agreed on, the phases and financing. And then the president's economic advisors, at a time of high inflation and interest rates, said, well, you have to give the president the chance to stop a phase if we feel like we can't afford it. Senator Kennedy couldn't accept that for understandable reasons. We then proposed a $17 billion first phase program with catastrophic in children. He couldn't accept that. So then we go into the Clinton administration. They tried. So here we are, more than 60 years after President Truman's call. We finally get this passed. And it survives, as you say, by the narrowest of threads. And we have a suit brought by four individuals, three of whom wouldn't be involved at all, because two are veterans who will get the federal benefits of federal VA coverage, and one will get Medicare, potentially upsetting a key part of the act, which provides federal subsidies to people who are both in states with state exchanges and those without state exchanges. And that's what's a challenge. We're talking about up to 8 million people who would suddenly be thrown out of the market, who need those federal tax credits. We're talking about working people. And this would have an implication far beyond these 6 to 8 million people, because without the tax subsidies, healthy individuals would be less likely to purchase the insurance. This is going to leave a disproportionate number of unhealthy people in the system, and it will raise premiums for everybody. So we're not talking about something that just affects 8 million people, although that's quite enough. We're talking about a ripple effect that could affect every single person with health insurance in the United States.
I understand that Teddy Kennedy always regretted that when Nixon essentially offered up comprehensive health care, he just outsourced all domestic to Senator Moynihan, later Senator Moynihan, Pat Moynihan, and he obviously had more interest in foreign policy. And my understanding is that Kennedy thought, no, they could do better. And then he realized that they didn't do better. And he kind of regretted the idea that he never took up.
I wish that had been the same attitude in 1980 in the Carter administration. I have great respect for Senator Kennedy, really great respect. He carried this as a life's cause. We should have been able to reach an agreement in the Carter administration. We came very, very close. I negotiated directly with him in his office in the Capitol. We agreed on everything, financing, the phasing. But then when the president's economic advisors said that because we had high inflation and high interest rates, we had to give the president the opportunity to stop a phase if he felt we couldn't, I knew that he couldn't accept that. But unfortunately, then when we proposed a major first phase $17 billion program covering children, all catastrophic coverage, and an expansion of Medicaid, he felt again, that it should be all or nothing. So on both sides, there were mistakes made. Now we finally have national health insurance, something I saw when I was ambassador to the European Union through the length and breadth of Europe. I mean, I can't tell you with my friends, with others that I met, what a comfort it is to know that when you get sick, or your children, or your spouse, or your parents, that you have insurance. And I want to stress that those who say, well, we can't afford it, in the United States, we spend about 16% of our total gross domestic product on health care. In the very European countries which cover everybody from cradle to grave, it's about 8%. So this is a cost-effective thing. And I'll give you a personal example. My cousin, an American, Marsha Micah, visited us in Brussels, and we drove with my wife to Paris. On the way back, she got quite ill, and we went into a small hospital in a suburb of Paris. They took her without any question. They never charged her, even though she was an American. It gave me a very personal feeling of how important it is to have that kind of coverage.
Again, I'm speaking with Stuart Eisenstadt, who's a former U.S. ambassador to the European Union. He was a domestic policy advisor for President Jimmy Carter and the Deputy Treasury Secretary for President Bill Clinton. But in a way, you're describing something that I think is a measurement of a civilized society. You know, there was some talk about instead of having a gross domestic product index, we should have a gross domestic happiness or wellness index. We are, of course, unique in our Constitution. It talks about the pursuit of happiness.
We talk about the uniqueness of America, and I believe it. I believe we are a unique country. But in this case, we're unique in the wrong way. We're unique in not providing the kind of coverage that almost every industrial democracy in the world provides. And it's really a tragedy. We cobble together pieces like Medicare and Medicaid, and now we finally have something with the Affordable Care Act that extends to tens of millions of people insurance, and we have the potential of knocking out up to 8 million people who depend on these federal subsidies and tax credits, 80% of whom, by the way, are working people, and this is not a racial issue. The majority are white people, suddenly thrown off their coverage because they can't afford it. This is going to have a ripple effect throughout the system and will raise premiums for everybody. But you're right. It's a values situation. What do we want the country to stand for? We want to have a situation in which people know that if they get sick, and this is the number one problem everyone has, that they don't have to scramble and worry about going into an emergency room with no coverage. We should be past that in the 21st century. We've been trying to get this since 1948 with President Truman. Now we have it, and it's hanging by a thread with this King versus Burwell case.
Well, given the history that you've told us about and that you've participated in, Stuart Eisenstadt, what is your explanation for the kind of pathology behind those that think somehow having health care is a bad thing? It's a very strange political argument.
For a very long time, there was a concern by insurance companies that somehow they would be out of the market if the government provided it. So this is what we were going to do in the Carter administration and in the Clinton administration and now in the Obama administration. We said, okay, we won't have one universal government payer, as they do in Europe. We will allow private insurance companies to sell into these exchanges. And by the way, they are now the strongest supporters of Obamacare because it increases their profits. But they had been opponents until recently. Then you've got the polarization where people on the right and the Tea Party people, anything that involves government is somehow tainted. But this is largely a private sector-led program. But it has that tinge as well. And then you add to it the enormous polarization. I mean, here we are talking today, the day before the Supreme Court decision, and our Department of Homeland Security, which is supposed to defend us, can't get funded because of a disagreement on an immigration provision. We have a highway trust fund that is depleted. It had been a bipartisan supported issue. And the right doesn't want to increase gasoline taxes for a few cents to help fund roads and highways and fill potholes and build rapid transit lines. So this enormous polarization is very much focused on the health care issue. It's an electric issue for the right and the left. And what we've lost in this country is the moderate middle, the people who could reach agreements in past years when there were differences. It's that middle that really is missing in American politics.
And is it, by extension, missing at the Supreme Court?
We'll see. It was not missing when it was 5-4. I'm hopeful that there will be a recognition that this was really an integrated bill in which there was an effort to cover everyone, whether they were in state exchanges or not. It wouldn't have made sense to have a situation in which a state could opt out of coverage and, in effect, then their citizens wouldn't get any federal subsidies. And I want to make it clear, these are, again, the very states whose governors rejected 100% federal payment for 2 years and 90% for the duration to expand Medicaid. So the citizens in these 34 states are going to be hit twice. First, because Medicaid wasn't expanded. And now the working people potentially could lose the federal tax credits, which enable them to afford for the first time in many cases insurance.
Well, in some of these cases, you have governors who are running for president. And it's sort of a badge of honor to be against Obama in any way, you know.
And this is a situation where we need to think of the country. You talked earlier about values. It's important to look beyond who the president is in any particular case and say, what do we think about our own citizens? What does a governor of one of these states, let's say Texas, or others that didn't take the Medicaid expansion and now will have millions of their citizens thrown on the market without insurance?
Wisconsin's an example.
These are constituents of theirs. So forget who the person is in the Oval Office. This is something that should unite everyone. The only forlorn hope, if they go the wrong way and overturn this, and it is a forlorn hope rather than a realistic one, is that it will finally, as the gallows concentrates attention, force Republicans and Democrats to sit down and say, we can't allow this situation. We can't pull coverage away from people who, for the first time, finally have it. We must come up with a solution.
Well, Stuart Eisenstadt, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Stuart Eisenstadt, who's a former U.S. ambassador to the European Union. He was the domestic policy advisor to President Jimmy Carter and a deputy Treasury Secretary to former President Bill Clinton. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.